oh, 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 O'Reilly.
Check engine, ABS, or maintenance light on? Take the guesswork out of your warning lights with O'Reilly Veriscan. The service is free and provides a report with solutions verified by ASE-certified master technicians. And if you need help, we could recommend a shop for you. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here. Wishing you a very happy half-off holiday, because right now, Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. If Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So, that means a half day, yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes of networks busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
How to Be a Liberal, the story of liberalism and its fight for its life, is a new book taking on the authoritarian right, from Dick Victor Orban in Hungary to Brexit in Britain to Donald Trump in America. Nationalists are launching an all-out assault on liberal values. In a new book, political journalist Ian Dunt tells the story of liberalism from its birth in the fight against absolute monarchy to its modern incarnations. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK, Ian Dunn. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I mean, I'm in my flat in London, but it might as well be anywhere because I've been in this room for about 12 months now. So yeah, it could be anywhere in the UK.
And how are you finding it as we approach? I always refer to it as BC, before coronavirus. But how are you finding it are you getting the bunting out for that first year anniversary? You know, that difficult relationship with the coronavirus.
Yeah, exactly. It's lots of celebration, which involves, you know, maybe having an extra glass of wine on a Friday night. That is like the sum total of the degree of hedonism that is available to us at the current
moment. Well, I must say, I applaud you for not having a glass of wine first thing in the morning, because everybody, you know, it's several of us down here in the far-flung outposts of southern Spain, you know, start with Baileys on our cornflakes. But there you go. Now, let's move away from that before we go down that particular rabbit hole. Your book, of course, How to Be a Liberal. Is it ever been harder to be a liberal? What's your definition of a liberal to begin with anyway, Ian?
It's basically that you believe in the freedom of the individual. It's as simple as that. Like, if you believe that the principles of politics, that the principles of morality, that the way you should conduct yourself and the kind of society that you want is based around the freedom of the individual, that everyone gets to do whatever they want until the point where their freedom interferes with someone else's freedom. Now, that sounds like a really easy thing to say, but the truth is, once you come up with this principle, you start instantly finding lots of very complicated issues that you come up against. For instance, are you free to smoke next to someone if that might, you know, potentially give them sort of a passive smoking? And then you get into a really complex debate on economics. Do you just get to keep all your money, or do we actually have to tax some of your money so that we can send it to people who are harder off so that they can have more freedom themselves? So it's this kind of, it's like a, you know, one of those video games that's based on a very simple idea, but is endlessly complex in order to actually become good at it. That's basically what liberalism is. It starts very simple and it blossoms out into really quite heavy degrees of complexity.
I mean, we've got pretty far ideas where sort of communism and Marxism come from, hence it's in the title of the name. But also when you look at fascism as well, you've got a pretty good title, unless you're going to go back to sort of ancient Rome. But liberalism, can we actually pin down a date and what the original spark for the liberal movement was?
No, you can't really. And there's a lot of debate around that kind of stuff. For me, it starts with René Descartes. He's a Frenchman who basically comes, sort of accidentally invents the individual when he's going through this process of doubt. And he thinks, what can I doubt? I can doubt everything. I can doubt that I have a body. I can even doubt maths. What is the one thing in the world that's purely, purely certain to me? And he says, I think, therefore I am. You know, if I'm doubting, there must be a me that's doing it. So he comes up with the individual, and he doesn't just come up with the individual. He comes up with the concept of reason, because the me that's doubting is using reason in order to establish your existence. And that moment, you get these kind of operating units of liberalism just splutter into life. And in the years that follow, you get the English Civil War, the French Revolution, the American Revolution, and slowly society just molds into these units that he created. But that's kind of a controversial point to start. Lots of people would start in a different place. To me, it is with René Descartes, this kind of very weird, very arrogant, quite unpleasant French philosopher, just stumbling across this truth by mistake.
And I mean, talking about, you know, you're talking about the Descartes and then the revolutions, English Civil War, of course, French Revolution, huge effects. But the main thing of that is, especially in the case of the French one, against an absolute monarchy, i.e., you know, the state is me, the Sun King, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So all of this stuff really begins in the fights against absolute monarchy and to a slightly lesser extent, the church. But the ideas that they come up with continue out throughout history. I mean, one of them, right, is the separation of powers. The separation of powers is basically that you can't have too much power in one place. You've got to carve it up, slice it up, balance it against itself. So we come up with ideas like we're going to have a parliament. In many cases, it's bicameral, right? So we'll split the parliament in two so that acts against itself. We're going to have a judiciary that does the law. We're going to have a press that holds everyone to account. Now, notice the way these ideas are expressed throughout that period, the American Revolution, French Revolution, Glorious Revolution in Britain. But right now, look at what Viktor Orban does in Hungary. Look at what Boris Johnson does in the UK. Look at what Donald Trump does. In each case, they attack the press. They attack the parliament. They attack the judiciary. They're still the same targets for people who seek for too much power. So you see already, like, those early liberal ideas on power, they act as these kind of protective barriers against tyranny. And the moment that you allow people in who start disrespecting those barriers, it is essentially an attempt to just amass a lot of unearned executive power from which they can rule much easier than if they face any scrutiny.
Would you say that liberals are currently under, you know, those with liberal leanings then have always been the target of those who go for a more populist stroke authoritarianism regime? If you see the way that the word liberal is bandied about, especially in the recent election campaign over in the States, it was close to, you know, close to sort of Satanist on the list of things in the well, let's face it, on the far right, to be described as a liberal, to be described as a liberal in the States was basically meaning that you were supporting the satanic cabals who were just having a nice, you know, glass of child's blood over the weekend.
Yeah, it's true, right? Well, it's almost always a term of abuse. So in the US, you know, the left doesn't really use it, but the right uses it against the left. Now, you go to France, and it's almost the mirror image of that, right? Like, liberal just kind of means neoliberal, you know, free market, Thatcherite sort of economics. You don't really hear it used on the right. So you get this weird situation where it's always a term of abuse. You know what a liberal actually is? It's just someone who wants everyone to be as free as humanly possible, who hates the people that peek through their curtains, who try to impose their own rules on someone else, who wants everyone to be able to operate on the basis of reason, not their emotion, not their tribalism, not dismissing experts, but to base things on what we know to be empirically and objectively true about the world and to use those ideas to expand freedom. So once you get past all of the vitriol and the propaganda and the sneering, what you find is a thing that many, many people instinctively agree with and that has massively expanded our well-being, our material wealth, and our quality of life and our freedom throughout centuries. But to do that, you've got to get past all the sneers.
Mm. Interesting, though, because the thing is, if you think about it, and you have described liberalism as, quote, an enormous, boisterous, confounding, bloody thing. Nice quote, Ian. But if you think about it, that what you just said about the breadth of knowledge that can be assumed, that can be gained and gathered and experiences gathered to put forth together a political narrative, opposed to, one could argue, the populist views that go down a very, very narrow political narrative, and anything left or right of that, and I mean to, I just in terms of deviating from the public view, be it a policy, a referendum, and I know that your thoughts on Brexit probably but need to be heard. You know, that's it's the complete. Whereas the authoritarianism looks at a very narrow focus. With a liberal, you've got a kaleidoscope to draw on.
Yeah, and you know what? There's something that's always kind of challenged liberalism in that it's not very satisfying. Right. Like, you get an authoritarian that comes along and they have a really simple narrative. Their narrative is it's the people versus the elite. You know, you're the people and you're defined by being the people by agreeing with me. The moment that you don't, you're now a traitor to the people, you know, whether you're inside the country or whether you're a foreign enemy. And there's the elite. And these are basically some kind of conspiracy that's going on in cultural circles and economics, in government, although weirdly enough, these people mostly are in government. So God knows who they're talking about. Now, both of those categories are false. There is no one such thing as the people. There's a bunch of individuals with different interests, different eccentricities, who have their own individual nature. They're not homogenous with each other. There is no one will within a country. There's lots of competing wills. And the elite is also a fiction. There's just different centers of power that sometimes operate against each other, sometimes apart. That is the truth of it, but it's a complex truth, right? It's always easier for populists and authoritarians to come with this really simple story that explains all the problems in your life through the use of an imaginary enemy. It's much harder to come along and go, actually, the world is insanely complex. The world of economics, the world of political power, the world of social power. These are really complex areas you have to break down and look at. But the truth is, if you don't do it, you can't improve people's lives. You can't improve people's lives on the basis of myth. This is why when you attack an imaginary enemy, it might be politically satisfying to people, but it will do nothing to actually make them wealthier, to make them more free, to make them live in a world that operates according to rational principles. So it is less satisfying. It is. You don't man the barricades with liberalism, but at the same time, it's the only thing you can promise people that will actually improve their lives.
Yeah, but isn't it entirely different? Isn't it incredibly depressing to be a liberal though in that case? Because in a society where dancing on ice makes the news, and you know who, you know, and the Sussexes is going on Oprah Winfrey already pre-recorded is seemed more valuable than the findings of, say, the Grenfell Tower. You know, people, the population is being spoon-fed a diet of mediocrity and pap, and therefore it is much easier, because you just talk about being intelligent and being informed. Well, if we give the people a diet of you know who's wearing what earrings and which Kardashian is doing what to anywhere else, how can they, you know, it's much easier for them to make an ill-informed choice and then go, well, the problem is because it's the polls at Tesco's.
Yeah, but you know what? This has always been the case, right? Like, you know, when you go back in the stuff that we read about in history, we always read about the important documents and the important movements. I mean, that was not what most people were talking about during that period. I mean, you look at the English Civil War. The English Civil War, this seminal moment in not just Britain's history, but international political history, because those are the ideas that informed the French Revolution, the American Revolution. But that's not what most people were worrying about at the time. You read the documents at the time. Most people around that period were just trying to avoid the whole bloody thing. So really, the truth is, it's always been this way. It doesn't mean that you can't equip people with reason and a sense of importance about their country. And I do think people have that in them. And just because they also like some frivolousness, like in the news and elsewhere, doesn't mean that they're not also committed to caring about the country that they live in. You can get through to people. But I think one of the things that liberals have to do is to take a page from the populist right and to think, not just in terms of the head, but also the heart. Like, how do we communicate? Is it a human way to communicate? Is it simple? Or do we just do all of our arguments in the courts, right, on human rights law, or in the civil service, sort of tinkering away with policy and leave the debate to other people? That, to me, is one of the reasons liberalism got itself into such a mess. You have to speak to people with passion, with conviction. You have to speak to their heart as well as their mind.
So when you come to write something like this, I mean, we've gone through, you know, we've done the English Civil War, we've done the French Revolution. What other, say, in the past, I just said casually throwing it out there, past 400 years, would you say are the high points of liberalism? And we don't have to mention Jeremy Thorpe in any of this conversation, obviously, because they're English liberal. But you see, looking at English liberalism, I mean, this would, you know, in the 18th and 19th centuries, liberal, you know, the Liberal Party, per se, Tories and Whigs, surely that was a movement. And it, do you think that liberalism in the UK then therefore has changed its character? Because now if people say liberal, they think the party, whereas being of a liberal philosophy isn't exactly the same as being in the Liberal Party, perhaps?
Yeah, no, you know what? I mean, I basically just don't pay any attention to parties that have the word liberalism in them, because most of them aren't liberal in any normal capacity. This is sort of, they were designed, whether you look at the Lib Dems in the UK, you look at the Liberal Party, you know, in Australia, most of the time, those words were just designed a bit like, you know, when you get like an Eastern European state with a party that says the Democrat Party or something, you're just saying, well, that doesn't necessarily mean they're particularly democratic. And I think it's that. It's sort of used as a badge to conceal an inner disposition sometimes. The story isn't really British, you know. The story is of these moments that shoot off and are then built. Especially, I mean, I have to say, overwhelmingly, that the countries are really Britain, France, and the US, where these ideas are just being shared and swirling around the world. The high point to me, and weirdly enough, in liberal history, the high points almost always come immediately after it nearly went extinct. So the high point for me really is the post-war period. It's just after fascism and communism acting as enemies, but really combining to extinguish liberalism and the individual, had almost triumphed. And you get this moment afterwards where liberals just think, you know, we came pretty close there, and they realize what the consequences are of liberal failure, the scale of death, the scale of human suffering that takes place when you stop caring about the individual. And they then built the world of international cooperation. Now, that's also partly the WTO, it was called the GATT back then, on trying to come up with rules that are fair on trade, that mean you don't get into tit-for-tat trade battles that can often escalate into war. It's human rights law across the world, in the UN, but also in Strasbourg, that means that individuals can get past the state and make their claims for bad treatment, for oppression, in a forum that doesn't rely on the state to defend against itself. And it's organizations like the EU that melded economies together, that operated on the basis of solidarity between countries and not competition between countries, to try and create like a really stable world where people will be able to become wealthier and more free. So on that basis, that is a startling moment, really, from sort of 1945 to the early 70s, of massive growth of human potential, of human wealth, that then started to cascade downwards, mostly under the influence of neoliberalism, and that eventually led us to where we are today. But that, as a high point, you've got 30 years of the most significant advancement in the history of man. And that is the kind of period that we'd be looking to go into again.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you say that about people wanting to be away from monolithic organizations, etc. And yet the Brexiteers would say, well, that's what we voted to do. We left the corrupt gravy train monster that is Europe, is the European Union.
Yeah, you know what I find? Yeah, I love this. I love this argument that he's, because the guy they just put in charge of negotiating with the EU is called David Frost, and he's not elected. He's another unelected bureaucrat. So it's quite amazing, you know, how the battle against it suddenly turns into its exact opposite. Most of that, imagine the freedoms that Britain just lost, right? I mean, imagine the freedom of movement. Like, you have got finally the chance to go anywhere you like on a continent, to love whoever you want, to work wherever you want. For many Brits on low incomes, this is sold as an anti-elitist thing. The truth is, for Brits on low incomes, for the first time ever, we're given the chance that they could actually just go and retire in Spain and with quite relatively cheap property. And now that has just been lost. For young people who often would be jobbing around Europe, they have now lost that ability to do it. And most of them on actually very low incomes are the ones that have been most damaged by this. So the level of freedom you lose, quite apart from the trade stuff, where we are now right now hammering British businesses, countless numbers of them going out of work because they're unable to ship the agricultural goods in time due to the extra bureaucratic requirements. The level of loss to me is staggering. And it's quite astonishing that a country's done it. It's basically a country imposing sanctions on itself.
Yeah, I'm sitting at the moment in a recording in a studio based in southern Spain. And as one of the 300,000 British people who are registered legally in Spain, who has lived here for more than 15 years, we were unable to vote in the future of our own future. And so what this has done for us, despite from the knuckle draggers back there saying, well, you shouldn't be able to vote, it's not your country. Well, it is my country. I just want to live in Europe. Thank you very much. I'll go back to the UK. I love the UK. But what it's meant is the amount of paperwork and stress and the whole thing. And I know, you know, I can't go from Spain, you know, get my residency. That's fine. It's not a problem. But I can't go nip over to Portugal and set up my business. And it's been absolutely the amount of paperwork and the whole thing, because like I said before, somebody didn't like having polls in Tesco's basically. And as you said, and just quickly, one of the things that's really, obviously talk about youngsters jobbing, it's just hit home to a load of people this season that because obviously we broadcast up and down the Costa Blanca, Ibiza, Mallorca, and the nightlife business. And I know this is unexpected, but people are finding this. People are finding the unexpected things. Those British discotheques and bars and clubs rely on public relations people and bartenders who are English normally. Because of Brexit, because of the new laws, you can't, as an 18-year-old, come over to Ibiza for summer, spend 3 months here and pick up a job in a bar, because that will be breaking EU law, because you are no longer an EU citizen and they have to offer the job to a Spaniard first.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, this is the thing. This is what we mean, right, when we talk about the freedom of the individual. Now, look at how many freedoms just got lost. Not only is the freedoms of Europeans living in Britain, who had treated this like their home and are now being forced into an extremely faulty, leaky, difficult bureaucratic process to prove their status. Freedom of Brits in Europe to be able to move around, to just decide, well, actually, to go on holiday somewhere in Europe and think, actually, I really like it here, I'm going to stay. Or even to meet someone they love and want to bring them back home. You meet, if a Brit out there meets a European and decides they want to come home, if they apply for a spousal visa, they need to show that they have income over £18,600 a year in order to be able to just bring them to bring their own wife or husband to come live with them. Now, this is a massive infringement on our freedom. This is what happens when you start breaking down individual freedom, when you start eradicating it. And yet people have done it gleefully. totally covering up the consequences of the actions. And when people ask, what freedom have we gained that we didn't have before, I hear an absolute deafening silence from the other side.
Absolutely. Right then, if people... So what can people take then? Why did you think the time was right then, Ian, to put this down? Because I know that you, obviously, you're editor of politics.co.uk, and you appear as a pundit, it says, on various bits on our TV channels and whatever. So why do you think the time was right then to put this down? Or had you actually, you know, thought, right, it's the right time, we're at this tipping point?
Well, I mean, if we're not fighting back at the moment, then... we get railroaded. And this can be done, right? Like, look at America. Like, imagine where we would be psychologically right now if Trump had just won a second term on the basis of the nonsense that he'd been spewing out and the policies that he'd pursued on militarizing the police against people seeking for racial justice. Like, imagine the despair that we would feel, but people galvanized, they organized, and they won. And that can be done all over the world. It can be done, you know, it can be done in Britain. It can be done in Hungary. I mean, Hungary, one of the things that concerns me about Hungary is the silence. You know, the lack of opposition to Fidesz. Fidesz has just gutted the democratic institutions of that country. It's gutting the press. It guts the parliament, the judiciary, and replaces it with Fidesz loyalists, with cronies. Now, on that basis, that is the terrifying prospect. It's when there's silence. Now, I don't see that at the moment in many countries. I see these bulging protest movements. I see people that are agitating for their values, who know that this is not the right way to go, and that there is a much better version of humanity, a much better version of politics that we can pursue. But to do that, we need to be able to articulate our values. And I think one of the things that happened to us as liberals is we kind of lost track of them. We became complacent, a bit fat, a bit bloated. We just assumed society would keep on going our way and that you didn't have to fight for it. But the truth is, you've got to fight these battles. Every generation, every year, you have to fight the battles for your values. And if you don't, they will stamp all over you.
I suppose one of the effects then of this, you know, of the vote out of Europe and the situation we find ourselves in all around Europe is the fact that it's perhaps shaken people up into action to say, hang on a second, you know, you see it as people realise that their basic rights are being taken away and their freedom of movement's been taken away and they can't, and down to a basic level where you can't get a shepherd's pie in British supermarkets over here anymore for love nor money because of the meat import. So this is perhaps a time to wake up and get involved and express that value, which is perhaps behind the beating heart of all human experience, liberalism.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. That you have to fight for your convictions. You have to realize the things that you did wrong. But ultimately, this comes down to imbuing people with that confidence to fight for their convictions, to ignore the nonsense lies that they tell to take away your confidence about you're disconnected from people's real lives, you're in a conspiracy with the elite. You can put that to one side. It is there to take away that sense of confidence, that sense of dynamism that you have as a liberal of wanting to make the world a better place. These guys are in it for themselves. They're not in it for the people. Whatever they say is the will of the people is whatever happens to be the thing that they want to do at any given moment. It's just a lie. Masquerading as virtue. You have to stand up for your principles, and if liberals don't do it now, they'll regret it for many, many years to come.
The book is called How to Be a Liberal. It's out at the moment. It's published. Excuse me, I've lost my note. Especially, I was going to say when exactly it's published. Ian, help me out here, please, because I've lost the note.
Published by Cambry, and yeah, it's available everywhere.
Marvelous. If people want to find you, or where can they get you on the social media? By the way.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at Ian Dunt, IANDUNT, and I'm very sweary on there, so I apologise in advance.
That's quite all right. We're almost about the watershed. What are you looking forward to then in the next couple of months, liberal-wise, then? What do you think is going to be the watermark?
I mean, look, the main thing at the moment is Biden has got to show that a different way works. And that is on all sides. You have to show that you can provide racial justice for people who've been alienated from sort of center-left politics, from liberal politics, by thinking liberals won't stand up for oppressed people. But you also have to show those old sort of Rust Belt towns that have been left behind by neoliberalism, that have just been left into the decline, that voted for Trump, that we can improve your life in a way that lying nationalism never will. Now, that is a big task, a historic task for Biden, and all the hope right now is that he can accomplish it.
The book is called How to Be a Liberal. It's by Ian Dunn. Ian, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you very much, sir. Take care.